This is The Urban Connection, the weekly show on issues that affect the community.
The struggle for equality obviously isn't over, but we're going to look at the steep human price paid for the African Americans' right to vote.
This voting rights war, the battle, started in the 1600s. This African who has property, which was what was necessary to have a voice in the community, he did everything he was supposed to do to gain the franchise, and then it was taken away from him anyway. So it's two steps forward, one step back, is the nature of race and the law in this country.
I'm Leonard Birdsong. The Urban Connection starts right after this.
Now, The Urban Connection continues. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Welcome to The Urban Connection. I have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Gloria Brown Marshall. She's a lawyer and a constitutional law professor at John Jay College in New York City. She's also a U.S. Supreme Court correspondent and a syndicated columnist. But she's also an author of several books. One we're going to talk about today, it's called The Voting Rights War, the NAACP and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. Professor Gloria, thank you for coming on The Urban Connection with Leonard Birdsong.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So tell us why you wrote this book.
Well, I wrote The Voting Rights War the last year of President Obama's term, second term. And I wrote it because I had a feeling, an instinct, that the energy, the spiritual nature of his two terms in office would ebb after he left office, and people would be searching, and that those people who supported him would want that spiritual feeling again when it comes to voting. And I knew that because he was a black man in the White House, there was this backlash, the nationalist spirit. I didn't know it would get this far into craziness, but I knew it was rising up, having a background in civil rights. And so I thought, maybe if I wrote this book to just remind people that voting is not supposed to be a church service. They're not supposed to go in a voting booth and look for the spiritual movement. It's a civic duty. It's a necessary part of our democracy. And to remind them of the voting rights martyrs I have in the book and the long road to where we are now, that this is an ongoing battle. This is not one battle won and we've won the war. The war is continuous because it's begun before the country started and it will continue probably after the country is over. But what really disturbed me was the sense that of the urgency. But it wasn't until well after that the book came out in 2016, but it wasn't until well after that that I realized how prescient it was to write about this topic in that time frame.
It really is prescient. I want to commend you for starting the book with a timeline of selective events and cases. You start with the fact that in 1619, 20 Africans from Angola arrived in the Jamestown colony. They were enslaved, and under English laws, to vote, you had to own property, be of good character, and be 21 years old, and of course, white. Let me ask you about some of the things that happened to African Americans after the Civil War when they tried to vote.
Well, I want to just touch on two things. One, even in the 1600s, those Africans, the 20-odd Africans that John Rolfe indicated in his journal in 1619 arrived in August, were considered free in a way, or at least indentured servants, because there were no slave laws in the colony.
Not then.
Yeah, so when Anthony Johnson, an African, gained property and had white and African servants of his own in the 1600s, at that point in time, there was nothing to forbid him from voting because they didn't have slave laws and they had not taken the franchise and limited it to Europeans. It was assumed that it was limited to Europeans, but now you have this juxtaposition of this African who has property, which was what was necessary to have a voice in the community. And so what the Burgesses did, the House of Burgesses, was create a law that made the Johnsons, his wife and he, aliens in the colony, forced them out and confiscated their land. So this voting rights war, the battle, started in that time frame, that he did everything he was supposed to do to gain the franchise, and then it was taken away from him anyway. So it's two steps forward, one step back, is the nature of race and the law in this country.
Right. I'm not the historian that you are, but I also read that free blacks, mulattoes, women, Native Americans, Jews, and Catholics were prohibited from voting in many of the colonies around 1762.
Yes, and it was interesting when we get to the point of literacy tests, poll taxes, and the grandfather clause. The literacy test was first created for the Catholic Irish, so to prevent them from voting or registering to vote, because the literacy test was based on the Protestant Bible. And so it was assumed that the Catholics wouldn't know how to answer the questions properly and wouldn't be able to pass the literacy test and gain their right to vote. But when the nationalist spirit, like this is the first time the nationalist spirit we have now, has been an ongoing theme, when that nationalist spirit took hold and it was determined that they wanted this to be a majority European country, even though it was majority people of color from the very beginning because it was Native Americans. And so, and it sometimes, just like South Carolina during the 1700s and early 1800s, was majority African American. So they wanted it to be a majority European and American country, and so that's when they started to relax the restrictions on voting rights for European immigrants and increase restrictions on Native Americans, African Americans, and the Chinese.
All right. All of this is true, and it's interesting, and many people in our community don't know about it, but what struck me about the book is that I knew about lynching, and I've written some stuff about that in my early time as a professor, but I didn't realize the awfulness of the fact of the lynchings for people who tried to vote after the Civil War, after they had the 13th and 14th Amendment. People were hanged for just trying to go to the voting polls and things like that. It was just awful. Most people don't know about this. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, and how terrible our Supreme Court was in failing to protect those rights, that there were actual conflicts between Congress and the Supreme Court. Congress was very conservative. Congress was more liberal. The Supreme Court was very conservative. It was made up of a lot of former slaveholders, and they carried that nationalist spirit as well. And that's why you would have the Supreme Court decisions like Dred Scott and Plessy versus Ferguson and the Civil Rights Act and so many more. And why it was necessary for the 13th, 14th, and the 15th Amendment, and the 15th Amendment in 1870 gave black men the right to vote, why they had to be amendments. Because Abraham Lincoln knew that if this was just a law of Congress, the Supreme Court was going to overturn it at its earliest convenience. So that's why he pushed for it to be amendments to the Constitution, so it couldn't be so easily overturned.
Right.
But yes, in those lynchings that took place, in the other types of terrorism that took place, there were civil rights laws from 1866, 1871, anti-Ku Klux Klan laws. But Congress knew the states were not going to protect the rights of African Americans. And so that's why that federal legislation was enacted. So when we think about civil rights laws, we have to go all the way back to right after slavery, when the attacks on Africans happened, and when the Congress, and these were all white men. And we must understand that. These are all white men who are voting for protections for the African Americans who are now citizens and wanted to exercise their rights to vote.
Yep. And many of them, as we are talking about, were lynched, that is, hanged and burned, and sometimes burned at the stake.
Mm-hmm.
But none of the people who did this were ever brought to trial.
No. I mean, and that's where our prosecutors failed. Our judicial system, our criminal justice system, they used to the phrase is just us, because when something happened with African Americans, the black codes that were put in place, because what they put into the laws, the state laws, and the U.S. Constitution allows the states to determine the qualifications for vote, and they would say a person of good stature in the community. And so good stature meant they could not have a felony conviction. And so they would have black codes, these criminal laws, that would lead to the false accusation and trumped up charges, and these black men who were, and women and children who were unfairly prosecuted and incarcerated in the convict lease system. And not only did it take their labor for free through the prison system, but it also made them unable to vote because now they were not considered of good character in the community. So the criminal justice system was triggered after the 13th Amendment, and the 13th Amendment abolish slavery and indentured servitude except as punishment for a crime. So the criminal justice system was used to undermine the vote as well as terrorism and the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and most people don't know about that. I certainly knew about it, having been teaching law for a while. But let me just have you talk a little bit about some of the things that kept people from voting, that is African Americans. You've already talked about literary tests that people had to read and write. So if they couldn't do that, they couldn't vote. But what about poll taxes? Many people don't understand poll taxes. What were they about?
Well, even the tests, when you think about, they got to the point in the 1950s where because this test was developed in the 1890s when the Mississippi Convention came together for the sole reason of undermining the black vote, because the black vote was powerful even in the 1800s. It's always been powerful. And so the sense to try to make the black vote seem unnecessary, it's always been able to change the outcome of an election. Whether or not we vote or we stay home, it makes a difference to the outcome of both local, state, and national elections. And so the Mississippi Convention of 1890 said, we're going to use this test, we're going to use the poll tax and the grandfather clause, and the poll tax, I mean, just like how many jelly beans are in a jar? How many quarters? You know, write an essay on the U.S. Constitution. So when people weren't passing the test, these were ridiculous questions. And there are poll taxes online if people want to go online and actually answer some of these questions and see just how convoluted and ridiculous it was meant to undermine the person registering to vote. The poll tax meant that a person had to pay a certain amount of money. But if you're a poor farmer, and a lot of these black farmers made so much less than their white counterparts, and they were under oppressive conditions. And so they had to choose, do you buy your child a pair of shoes or do you pay this tax? And you had to pay this money, and those people who could pay it, this is even makes it even worse, is that they had to pay it to the sheriff.
Right.
So the register of elections was in the sheriff's office. So that alerted the sheriff, oh, you're a troublemaker. You want to actually exercise your right to vote. And that could mean a wife or daughter being raped. It could mean the night riders coming to terrorize the people, poisoning their cattle, burning down their farmhouses. It's ridiculous. I don't know how this country ever got this notion around the world that it was this democracy, the shining light on the hill. I mean, this is a molehill. I'm missing where the shining light on the hill comes from. And then the grandfather clause was, if your grandfather couldn't vote, that was if they couldn't vote prior to 1866, then the children could not vote. So, of course, we know that, you know, the 1870 amendment, 15th Amendment, you know, was after 1866. So it was all meant to prevent black people from voting without putting it in a racial way on the face of the law.
Gloria, hang on. We're going to take a quick break and return for more. Our guest is Gloria Brown Marshall, constitutional law professor and the author of the book, The Voting Rights War, the NAACP and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. We'll continue in a moment here on The Urban Connection.
More of The Urban Connection straight ahead. Stay tuned. Let's return to The Urban Connection. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
We're back with Gloria Brown Marshall, constitutional law professor and civil rights lawyer, and the author of the book, The Voting Rights War, the NAACP and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. And we're talking about the NAACP's efforts to achieve voting equality at the Supreme Court. So, Gloria, those efforts have been through various forms of litigation, legislation, and protests, right?
Yes, and I put that trifecta together after reading all of their work, and I summed it up in litigation, legislation, protest. And I say that these are the three elements necessary for social change. When you see protest by itself, you see that it falters, and there has to be a vision for these things. What is the vision for litigation, the legislation, and the protest? But those three elements have to come together in a strategic way, and the NAACP learned this over time and used it effectively for a very long time. I think it's somewhat on the path back to that now, but now we're dealing with something, the criminal justice system that was always there. Now it is the engine. It is the new slavery of the 21st century, not in just the way it's undermined the black community as a family, economically, politically, but it's also given us this civil death. And the civil death are the millions of people who still don't have a right to vote because they have a felony conviction.
That's right. You're absolutely right. I'd like to mention some crucial names in the effort to get voting rights in the 20th century. And maybe you can explain who they were and what they did. First, who was Charles Hamilton Houston?
Charles Hamilton Houston is my spiritual crush.
Okay. All right.
I mean, Charles Hamilton Houston, a brilliant man. We know that Barack Obama was the second black person to make law review at Harvard. Charles Hamilton Houston was the first black to lead the law review. He was the first black person on the law review at Harvard Law mm-hmm. School. And what really got me is he was the son of a lawyer. He was from Washington, D.C. He served in the military in World War One. He and so many other black soldiers were treated so horribly that he swore to himself that he would do everything he could to end Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 case of the Supreme Court that created apartheid in this country. It was separate but equal. That was never equal. And so Charles Hamilton Houston was someone who was a lawyer working for the NAACP's legal committee, and he was the dean of Howard Law School. He created the power of the appellate training of civil rights attorneys. So Thurgood Marshall was one of his proteges and so many others who were trained at Howard Law School, not just to bring a case, but to take the case all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's what's missing right now. And that is something that I'm advocating for. We must have civil rights attorneys trained to take these cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I want black attorneys trained to do this. We see now that it's necessary for us to have our voice in our own destiny. No other group has another person outside of that group creating the litigation and strategic plans for the outcome of that group. So you don't have women having men lead the National Organization for Women. You don't have Catholics leading, you know, Jewish organizations. And we should not have people who are not black and care about being black. I don't want somebody in there who doesn't like being black, but people who actually have the vision of our community in mind. And so Charles Hamilton Houston had all that and the skill, and he literally died working himself to death, and he laid the groundwork for Brown versus Board of Education, which struck such a near-death blow to Plessy versus Ferguson.
That's right. Now, what about the name Constance Baker Motley? Can you tell us about her?
Constance Baker Motley was another protege who coming through the chain of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And Constance Baker Motley worked out of New York. She was an attorney who worked under Thurgood Marshall. And she became not only someone who fought civil rights cases in the South, but she also came back to New York, ran for public office, became a judge, a federal court judge, and her legacy lives on not just for African-American women, but for civil rights generally. As someone who, as a graduate of Columbia, I think she was one of two women at the time, who set her mind to doing for the community what she saw was necessary, to take her talents and apply them as best she could. She put herself in danger many times in the Deep South, and to the point where they said, you have to come out. You can't stay down there anymore. Because I worked for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and I know as an attorney, I traveled around the South alone. In my car, my rental car, to my cases, I represented children in desegregation cases. If you can imagine, we were still doing desegregation cases in the 1990s into the 2000s. So she made her name not just for African-American women, but for civil rights generally, and not just as an attorney, but as a jurist.
We jump over to 2013 now. Tell us what happened with the Voting Rights Act that was passed in 1965.
Well, the Voting Rights Act was an act, as you know, that has a trail of blood leading up to it.
Yep.
Of so many who lost their lives. What we know about and what we don't know about. And what I really like about my book is that I'm able to give the names of people, not there's so many more, but at least give the names of the people who died fighting for voting rights. And so by the time we get to 1965 and Johnson signs this, you know, we've had the three attempts and final victory over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. But then there's always been this fight to undermine it, especially the pre-clearance clause that actually says that a state that's under the jurisdiction of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which does not give the right to vote. People thought that. No, it doesn't give us the right to vote. It protects that right.
That's right.
And so that pre-clearance clause meant that a jurisdiction had to have any changes to the laws of their voting laws pre-cleared to make sure that there were no discriminatory portions to that law, pre-cleared by the federal government or a three-judge federal court. What's so insincere about it is that our now Chief Justice John Roberts, as an attorney, came up with a plan of how to gut the Voting Rights Act of this precious pre-clearance provision. And when he rose up to be Chief Justice, they had him in line, in place, just to make sure he gutted the Voting Rights Act. And so when he delivered the opinion, it was with such insincerity, since he knew that the very provision that he was supporting as constitutional was the one he helped create a generation earlier when he was a young conservative attorney. And in June of 2013, it was gutted. And unfortunately, it was in such a way in which we've not been able to recover. And so the long, drawn-out litigation, the expense, everything that has to go into fighting a voting rights case was something that President Johnson knew that the preclearance clause would have us avoid and would be much more effective. And that's why it had been such a target since 1965 when it was enacted.
Your book is The Voting Rights War, the NAACP, and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. But you also wrote some other books. One was Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to the Present. And you wrote about the Constitution and African-American content. And I think you wrote The Constitution, Major Cases and Conflicts. You do this writing because you are a professor. Is that right?
No, I do this writing because I'm a writer. And my last book is The African-American Woman, 400 Years of Perseverance. And that's more of an eclectic book that includes my essays as well as poems. And one of the poems I have in the book is Enjoying the Darkness, which speaks to the delight of being African-American. And too often we talk about the opposition and oppression, but we also need to talk about the joy, in the sense of camaraderie, of the pleasure, of the pride in our culture. And we need to say more about why we enjoy being African-American, our history beyond slavery, and everything that we've contributed to this country and to the world. So we need to revel in those accomplishments of the perseverance, of the resistance that allowed us to be in this interview right now.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, you know, I want you to keep up fighting the good fight. You were a civil rights lawyer, and now you are a writer and a speaker. I heard that you were over in Paris not too long ago, and you spoke to a group of many African Americans there, and you went over very well. Did you enjoy
Thank
that?
Thank you. And I was just at the National Press Club last week speaking about my book, The African-American Woman, 400 Years of Perseverance. And I have a lot of speaking engagements around the country on the issues of the voting rights war, but not just that, the black suffragettes. And there are so many black women who work to get the black men the right to vote, who work in their communities and have the highest voting rate of any group. Black women are so organized. We are worthy allies, seeking worthy allies as voters.
Yeah, you know, I just want to sort of tell our audience, as I recall, that black men got the right to vote in, what was it, 1870? So it was 50 years before women got the vote in the United States. Isn't that awful?
Yes, and that's why I'm speaking many places, because this is the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote, and it's the 150th anniversary of the 15th Amendment granting black men the right to vote. So this is a pivotal year. It's a 2020 census year, national election. So much is happening around voting rights.
Yep. Gloria Brown Marshall, the author of the book, The Voting Rights War, the NAACP, and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. Thank you so much for being with us on The Urban Connection.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for this week. I'm Leonard Birdsong, inviting you to join us right here next week for more of The Urban Connection.
That wraps up this episode of The Urban Connection with your host, Leonard Birdsong, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of The Urban Connection.